Well, Joshua Warren is our guest this hour. We'll take some phone calls with him. Also get into some more of his ghost stories next hour. Open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Joshua Warren with us. We'll take your calls. Joshua, this is the fourth year since a ghost was captured at the Asheville School on camera. Tell us about that story.
Yes, George. You know, this is a fantastic transition from the conversation we had last hour. And in fact, during the break, I checked my email and a listener said, you guys are messing around trying to create a he put it, quote, ectoplasmic Frankenstein.
You may be right, huh?
He's right, yeah. You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but he said, you know, you better be careful. And, you know, the funny thing is, this Asheville High School apparition is a great demonstration of a very complicated concept, which has previously been only philosophical, but is now becoming quite scientific, as we see. For one thing, if those who are online have access, I've got this video and some enhancements I did on my site, joshuapwarren.com. I know it always gets slammed when I come on Coast, so, you know, keep on trying. And what you see is this apparitional form that looks very humanoid, and it moves from one hallway to another. And the weirdest thing is that it casts a shadow. Now, before we get into...
Wait. It casts a shadow?
Yes.
A ghost casts a shadow?
There you go, George. Okay, that's the tricky thing. You almost never see that. You almost never see a ghost casting a shadow. Now, in order to try to figure out what this means, let's think a little bit about how we traditionally look at ghosts in general. As I'm fond of saying, if you take a human being and if you were to hypothetically, you know, squeeze all the water and empty space out of a living person, you would end up with a tiny ball of matter about the size of a pea. And in fact, if you examined that matter under a microscope, you would see that what you could measure is composed of the same types of atoms as inanimate objects, as chairs and rocks and planets and things like that. And furthermore, you can look even deeper and see that the particles within those atoms are moving and vibrating in the very same way these particles and atoms are vibrating in, quote-unquote, inanimate objects. So is it possible that all things in the universe, including stuff we usually consider inanimate, have some degree of consciousness? And we, of course, are always thinking, well, we are the special ones. We are the independent conscious beings, and those are the inanimate objects. But what if there is a kind of a gray, fuzzy area there where we, as sort of egocentric conscious beings, can take whatever is in our brain power here and merge it with various debris and who knows what stray energies are in the environment to create things that are not quite animate nor inanimate, not quite conscious nor unconscious. And maybe that's what some of these tulpas are, just like this thing that we created with the apparition experiment. Now, that said, we have to wonder, okay, to what degree is this thing physical? You think of a ghost, in some cases, as being something that is at very least translucent, in some cases almost transparent, and yet once in a while you do get what looks to be a very solid piece of evidence, because to this day, 4 years later, there is no evidence that anybody hoaxed this video from Asheville High School. There's no evidence of any interference with the security system, but you can see very clearly this apparitional figure is throwing a shadow. And what that means is that when these ghosts appear, if indeed this is what we're looking at, a true apparition, they actually do have a bit of physicality to them, which is why that, even if they're plasmas, you look at a candle flame. A candle flame is a plasma, and if you put it in front of a bright light, it will throw a shadow on the wall. So plasmas can produce these types
sure.
of effects.
And this is unlike shadow people, right?
I've always been a little bit unclear about how to define, quote-unquote, shadow people, because shadow people, based upon just the, if you just really listen to the reports that the witnesses have, these are simply sort of grayish, nondescript forms that look like three-dimensional shadows. And so in the most generic way, you can say that this is a shadow person. But if you start really looking at the pattern of behavior that people often describe and associate with shadow people, sometimes they say, I think more often than not, that when they notice the shadow person instantly vanishes. It zips away.
Yeah.
And even I had, you know, a similar experience that I told you about last hour. And so the shadow person phenomenon could be one of two things. It could be a typical ghost that is only partially manifested, and so we have this kind of grayish, you know, form. Or it could be, and this is where we get on, you know, way out there in some crazy theories, it could be that these are interdimensional beings or time travelers from the future that do not want to be observed. They like to watch us, but the moment we notice that they are looking at us, they hightail it.
Off they go.
You know, they don't want to interfere with what we're doing, either because it could screw up their own timeline, or maybe these are predatory beings that sort of absorb and feed off of our energy, and it doesn't work so well once we see them and clam up.
All right, let's go to the phones if we can. You ready?
Sure.
Let's take some. We'll come back and talk more, but we'll go to Sherman Oaks. Carlos is with us on the wild card line. Hi, Carlos. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. Hey, I have a ghost story. I don't know if how much relates to this. It has to do with poltergeist. I was in a house that I lived in Studio City. It was built on a Indian burial ground, and there was all kinds of things. They had to cement the back door because it would open by itself. There was a hump that grew in the floor of my brother's bedroom that had to be fixed. I had the weirdest thing happen, though. Poltergeist, apparently, I heard a bunch of noise from my bedroom. I run in the living room, and my cats are being thrown from either side of the door at the door. And something was picking them up when they'd run about 6 feet from the door on either side, two cats. One was running left, one was running right, and they would pick them up and throw them about 2 feet above the bottom of the door. And it did this about four or five times to each cat that I saw. So it must have been, you know, more than that. Because I heard all the noise before that. Something I couldn't see picked them up and threw them. As if I envision like maybe somebody lying down, like somebody very tall, could have, their arms, as far as the cats got. That would have been their hands in reach. They would have thrown it back. And I opened the door. There's another cat standing outside. Yeah, I don't know if that has anything to do with it. But the house was supposedly haunted. I knew other people who lived in that house before that saw things.
I love those stories. Thanks for sharing that with us. Josh, are ghosts becoming more physical?
yes, they certainly are, George. And in fact, you know, Carlos's story is a great example of the amount of physical power, of course, that he even experienced if cats were literally being hurled. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that it was a Native American area at one point, maybe a burial ground. We hear that a lot, but if that's true, I mean, Native Americans often shared this view that everything has some level of consciousness, and they had a very complex relationship with animals, hence totems and whatnot. But all that said, you know, last year, the Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded to a couple of men who finally proved, after many years of speculation, that the entire universe actually is accelerating. Every particle of the universe is accelerating. It's difficult for us to imagine precisely what that means, but it's a true physical effect. And if you look at this as a wavelength, like a sine wave, with very sort of large loops on one end that get smaller and smaller and smaller toward the other end as it picks up speed, what you're seeing here is that the wavelength is shortening. And as the wavelength shortens, it actually brings energy fields into closer contact than they were before. And I think that this is something that probably happens in cycles anyway all throughout history. But we are certainly going through a major cycle right now where ghostly phenomena, which was at one point in time sort of semi-physical, is now not only becoming more physical, but it's becoming more physical more quickly. That you see these effects happening at a faster rate. You don't have to wait so long between one experience and the next. And that's why I'm getting more and more reports now from people who say, I saw a ghost and I had no idea it was a ghost at first because it looked like such a physical, solid person. I just assumed it was some person who was acting weird, wearing some funny clothes, and it wasn't until, you know, the person vanished or I saw that the person was half in or half out of an object or whatever that I saw something freaky was going on here. And it takes people a moment to process this and figure out, oh my God, I've just seen something amazing, because when they first see it, obviously, they're usually not looking for a ghost. And it looks so relevant, and it just looks so so solid, they just can't think of that and the traditional mindset of a ghostly, ephemeral, sort of non-corporeal way. And so, yes, I think there are a number of reasons that we can cite here for why ghostly phenomena is becoming more tangible.
Okay, next up, let's go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jeff's with us, first-time caller. Jeff, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, guys. It's been a really fascinating discussion to listen to. And I've seen the trailer for the movie. Can't wait to go see it. You actually mentioned something that I wanted to talk about. I was wondering if your research was based on Tibetan mystics saying that they can produce thought forms called tulpas. And also, I don't know if this is relevant at all, but in the Bible, the number 7 is supposed to be the number of completion. So maybe that's why your thing formed in 7 days.
Wow. You know, Jeff, I hadn't even thought of that. You're right. 7 is a very sacred number in many different ways. I mean, you have, what, 7 notes in the music scale, 7 colors in the spectrum. I mean, yeah, absolutely right. This is why I love coming on Coast, because I get wrapped up in so many details sometimes that it's easy for me to overlook something that should be more obvious. But that's a great, great point. And also, Jeff, yes, the Tibetan idea of the tulpa is central to all of this. And in fact, when Warner Brothers first contacted me, I don't think that they were really even familiar with that term. But from what I understand, it actually ends up being used in the movie. And one of the first times I encountered that term was reading The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. And, of course, it's simply the idea that humans might be able to, if you will, give birth to things directly from their minds, and that you know, we understand how all that works in the biological sense, but the physical stuff is always sort of transitioning and decaying. Maybe you can give birth to something directly through the mind, and if it is envisioned distinctly enough, it will take on some space-time in our shared reality. And, of course, one of the stories that I love about this is the story of Walter Gibson, the guy who in the 1920s and 30s lived in Greenwich Village and wrote the shadow novels based on the character from the old radio shows, you know, the Shadow
Knows. Shadow Knows, yep.
And he was, you know, Walter Gibson was so intense in his writing of novels, he could crank out, you know, a novel in 2 weeks, and he would go, he would hole up in his house, you know, in seclusion, and after he left, you know, and this is after writing numerous novels for years, people who lived in his house claimed it was haunted by his fictional characters. They'd see the shadow whipping around the corner, or some villain, you know, running across the hallway, and that would be a very classic traditional tulpa. And so now that we are taking that same concept and boosting it with technology, we may be opening Pandora's box.
Josh, some say that maybe we are already dead.
That is a fantastic point, George, because, you know, there was a time.
We're in a dream.
Well, you know, there was a time when the idea that the past, present, and future were all happening at once and that we're simply passing through it was thought of as philosophical or metaphysical nonsense. Now you look at the latest cosmological models, and they all indicate that every piece of evidence we have shows that the laws of time and physics are supposed to be able to operate equally moving forward or moving backward. The reason that we don't experience it ourselves in both directions is because that we are physically moving in one direction due to the Big Bang. But all that said, if indeed we look at everything we know about time and we say that past, present, and future are truly relative, then that means that you and I have always been here. We are dead to people in the future. We are interdimensional to people from the past. And it may be that we have this unfortunate habit of simply defining our place in time based upon the cycle that our physical bodies currently happen to be in, but that our consciousness is related to every point in time throughout all time. And so when you encounter a ghost, it may very well be that you are in fact the ghost to that person. Whether you are an interdimensional time traveler from the future or you are some ghost of the dead from the past, you are sort of like in a little wormhole there. And therefore, it may be that all of us in some way are just as literally dead as the specter that you may see in a haunted house at any given time.
Next up, let us get a quick one from Angeletti, truck driving west of the Rockies in Idaho. Hi, Angeletti.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good. Good to have you with us.
I had a question more so for Josh. Whenever I've thought about ghosts before, any type of thing like that, I've always considered the idea that everything in a sense has energy and it has to go somewhere, whether that body's dead or not, there's going to be energy leaving it. And so with that, with Josh's experiment, would it be a feasible idea that maybe her thoughts form together as a similar energy, considering they're, you know, such large mass that you, with your whole setup you have, and that could explain possibly the idea that all your electrical burned out through there. I mean, if you run too much energy through a wire that it can't handle, you know, it's going to burn out. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, I guess.
30 seconds. Josh, go for it.
Angeletti, that is a great point because it's a little bit spooky, and I'm sure that Shelley Wright will not want to hear this, but what if by draining so much of her energy out of her brain through this machine to create something that manifested in a different being, we shortened her life some? It's an awful idea, but we don't know exactly what we're doing. You know, Einstein said if we knew what we were doing, we wouldn't call it research. And boy, you know, you bring up a darn good and creepy point.
More to come with you, Josh. Final segment, Joshua P. Warren, our special guest, and we will be right back with him. Don't go away. Well, next hour, we'll have open lines here on Coast to Coast AM, included the Somebody Cursed Me hotline, which I'm going to give you that phone number now so you'll be ready to roll when we get to open lines. That is 818-817-0021. 818-817-0021. That line alone reserved for you if you've been cursed. And, of course, you can call any of the lines when we get going into open lines. But that one is just for the cursed line. We'll be back in a moment with Joshua Warren, who has not been cursed yet on Coast to Coast AM. Josh, you've never been cursed, have you?
Well, I've been called a lot of names.
I don't mean like that.
No, yeah, actually, I have been cursed, I believe. Yes, I believe very strongly I was cursed one time.
By who?
Well, it was a friend of mine who
Nice friend.
Quote, unquote, friend. Who was dabbling in a lot of the dark arts. And actually, I kind of opened myself up to it a little bit because I was curious. This was many years ago, and I wanted to know if he was getting results. Now, of course, I know that you get results when you do these things.
Yes, you do.
You can project a thought like a bullet and make an impact. But you may recall, I'm sure, a time or two in our conversations over the years, I brought up to you how that one morning I woke up and there was a big, long snake slithering into my bed. You recall that?
I remember that. I remember.
Yeah, and once I remedied that problem, there was a second snake. Well, this happened right after I'd had a falling out with him, and he had said he was going to send some dark energy my way. And a lot of things just started going wrong in my life, just little things, just mechanical stuff failing, and just a lot of agitation in my social life. And then, of course, it sort of climaxed when these snakes came into the house. And this is where I lived years ago. But at that time, what was so weird was that apparently, from what I can tell, these snakes, they entered the house on the opposite side. They went all the way through the entire house. They went all the way past my fiance, now my wife, all the way around the bed to my side. And they came up specifically to me. Of course, I had to start studying at that point, like, what do I need to do to neutralize this? How, you know, and I had to learn a little bit of white magic at that point. But I wrote about some of this in a book I published years ago, which is called Pet Ghost, which I've never really cared for the name because it's really a book about more than just pets. It's a book about also non-human apparitions. And these are what you might consider harbingers, that there are times when I think animals can be charged with a specific purpose by a knowledgeable practitioner. And you have to see it to believe it. And that may also be why that sometimes flies and things congregate around places that are haunted, because there is an energy of death which is different from the aroma of death. So when a body dies, flies start appearing on it from miles and miles away, much, much farther away than they should be able to smell in that period.
Well, that's a good point. And they get to it from the weirdest places. You know,
yeah,
you could
like they're attracted to the energy of the decay as opposed to anything that we can measure.
That is weird. Final calls here. We'll go to Chris in Scarsdale, east of the Rockies. There you go, Chris.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this movie. I went down to New Orleans recently for my second time, and I took a tour of some of the paranormally active places. And I visited the outside of the LaLaurie House, which actually the interior of it is off limits, but it's considered the most haunted house in, you know, the entire nation, especially in the city of New Orleans. And I did photograph it, and oddly, the photographs came out in black and white, despite the fact that I have a perfectly working color camera. And I was just thinking, is this some sort of residual time loop from that era when black and white photography was used, possibly?
Well, you know, Chris, that is, I'm so glad you called. And one of the reasons is that a few months ago, I also was at the LaLaurie House. I mentioned toward the beginning of tonight's program, I'm very fortunate. I have a new TV series that I'm one of the cast members in that comes out on the Travel Channel next month on September 28th. It's called Paranormal Paparazzi. And I was one of a handful of reporters that was sent around the country to investigate all manner of strange things, and not just your usual ghosts and UFOs, but some things that are even trickier to classify. Well, I went to New Orleans as a part of doing this program, and so one of my paranormal paparazzi moments was, you know, trying to see if I could get into the LaLaurie Mansion. And it was really weird because I was standing below this place, and for listeners who don't know, I mean, the stories about what happened inside this place are absolutely horrific. I mean, basically, there was a fire in the 1800s, and when they went inside, the firefighter-type folks, the local residents, they discovered that Madame LaLaurie had been torturing her slaves in the most despicable, horrifying ways you can possibly imagine. You can look it up. I won't go into detail. But now they won't let anybody sort of go in there, and I ended up having a conversation with the current caretaker, who is up on a ledge smoking a cigarette, talking down to me. And I couldn't talk the guy into letting me inside. So I'm really fascinated with this place. So I don't know firsthand about what you might experience inside that place, but I can tell you that from the outside street, if you are photographing something and it's supposed to be in color, and it turns out being black and white, well, that doesn't happen very often. But one explanation is that, and this is pretty far out there, but that you may actually have some type of, well, for lack of a better word, a psychic ability, Chris, and that you were sort of subconsciously participating in what they call projection photography, that sometimes you might be able to imprint an image on your photographic medium, which, of course, in this day and age can be digital or film, from your mind's eye.
Wow. And I know Ted Serios wrote extensively about this.
There you go. Absolutely.
Yes, and there was an X-Files episode on it as well in the fourth season.
And so it could be that, you know, if you are connecting with a past time and your perception of that past time was black and white, which is common because, you know, we always look at things based upon what we're familiar with, and you and I are familiar with looking at black and white photographs of old things, you could have created that effect. Or it could be that there is literally something physically warping the way that the light travels between that location and the lens of your camera, which is distorting the way the camera's CCD is registering the colors. And that's one of the reasons that in extreme cases, camera stuff often fails when something paranormal is happening, especially if it's something ufological or if it's a very haunted place. It's common for people to experience camera failure. So you might have documented some aspect of that energy being warped, not enough to make your camera fail, but enough to show us there is a distortion taking place. And if you would, Chris, please email me those pictures if you don't mind. Just go to joshuapwarren.com, and you'll find my email there.
Joshua, I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead one more time.
Oh, yes, I did walk over briefly to the tourist booth on Canal Street one night, and I did ask, what's it up with this Lori house? They said it would be a great tourist attraction, bring in a huge amount of money, ghost hunters, et cetera. And the guy's answer was interesting. He says people could go in there and be so spooked that there could be tremendous lawsuits, heart attacks, whatever. And I know people can go into other, you know, equally haunted houses, be it Waverly Hills Sanitarium, be it Merle's Plantation, et cetera, you know, very paranormal active places. You can go indoors. But this particular one is considered a higher energy than all of those. And, you know, they say it's privately owned and all that, but what this man told me, the issue was because of you know, risks of heart attacks and, you know, and other types of physical injury, that's the reason they do not have an interior tour of that house.
Well, you know, Chris, Nicolas Cage owned that house for a short period of time.
He owned many.
yeah. He you know, apparently likes these kind of dark, spooky areas. There was a rumor that Johnny Depp owned it, but I found that there was no evidence. But sure enough, Nicolas Cage did own it. Who knows what he was going to do with it? But now that place is under lock and key, and I can understand why that if there is a true liability risk because it's so darn haunted in there, they would keep it locked up. And I, you know, the funny thing is I can't see how they're benefiting from it. It's not a tourist attraction anymore. I don't know what's happening inside there. And it's one of the great mysteries right now in this country.
Hey, Josh, you went to Coral Castle in Florida, didn't you?
I sure did. And, you know, at long last, and thanks for bringing that up, George, because that's something that seems to come up at least, you know, once a year, something like that, when I'm on the show. Somebody will call in and they'll ask me about Coral Castle, especially since I live in North Carolina. So, you know, I'm within somewhat convenient driving range of Florida. And I have read about the Coral Castle for years. For those who don't know, of course, there was this man named Ed Liedskalnin who was, he was from Eastern Europe. I think it was maybe Latvia or something like that. And from 1920 to 1940, he single-handedly working largely under the cover of night, created this very impressive structure. And it's a big castle built of blocks of coral that weigh many, many tons. And nobody to this day has been certain about precisely how he did it. He claimed he did it because he was creating a monument to his lost love, his sweet 16, as he called her, a girl named Agnes that kind of broke off an engagement. Anyway, so it's sort of been considered America's Stonehenge. And years ago, I read through some of the literature that Ed Leedskanen had written about magnetism and what he called perpetual motion and his ideas that the Earth does not simply have a static magnetic field. We know, of course, it's changing, but he believed that it was sort of flowing like a current from north to south. And he had various experiments that would indicate that. And so a lot of people read that and they thought, well, this guy must have figured out how to tap in to some subtle Earth energy. And you combine that with, of course, these stories about, say, young boys in the area who would sneak up into the tops of trees at night and watch him secretly, claiming he was hovering boulders and stuff around. It has created a very mystical aura around the guy. But I have to say, when I was there, I got into a really good conversation with some of the guides who worked there. And these are our fellows who are scholars. And one of the guides said, I want to show you something. And he opened up a binder, and he showed me some pictures I'd never seen before. I don't even know now if you can find some of these on the net or not. You know, I just got back from Florida. But there are pictures of Ed Leedskanen building the Coral Castle. Have you ever seen these before, George?
I may have. I don't know if it's the same ones you're talking about, but he was very small, 120 pounds, frail-type guy.
Yeah.
Sneaking around.
I didn't realize. You always hear, like, nobody knows how he built it. So to see pictures of him building it that some locals took, that was really a joy for me.
He always chased people away, though.
Yeah, well, what he did was he essentially, based on these pictures, he created these large wooden tripod-like scaffolds. And
right.
He would.
It looked like tripods. Yep.
With chains and gears, and he would pretty much hook a chain onto a block. He'd drive a wedge under it, lift it up just a little bit, hook it to the back of his pickup truck, pull it a little bit, and then he'd put a larger wedge under it. And he would do this painstakingly, and over 20 years, block by block, inch by inch, he was able to erect this magnificent structure. And so this is proof that I don't believe everything I hear, George. I think that the Coral Castle was built by using ingenious understanding of mechanics and leverage and sweat and muscle and pickup truck, but I don't think there was anything supernatural.
Really? Okay, well, did you know that when he moved it to Homestead, Florida, from another area in Florida, the truck driver showed up, and Ed chased him away and said, just leave your truck, I'll have these blocks on it when you come back. And so the truck driver left the body of the truck. Leedskanen, he had those blocks by himself, put them all on the truck, like within hours.
Really?
And nobody knew how he did that. Truck driver came back. He was in shock.
I hadn't heard that story.
And then he once told people he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built.
Oh, yeah, I have no doubt. He
so
knew
who
secrets.
Knows? Let's take some final calls. But interesting that you think he made it naturally. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Richard's with us, first-time caller. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Gustav Vigeland was another real strange artist in stone, too. But that's not why I called. I would like to briefly, you mentioned the shadow people earlier, and I'd like to, in 2005, I realized that other people had seen these things. I wouldn't be trying to tell my story now if I hadn't so many people back me up. But when I was a kid, I used to get, a lot of weird stuff happening, and I really couldn't put my finger on it. But when I turned about 15 years old, I'm going to just run this incident down.
Okay. Verbatim, only got about a minute or so for you, so go ahead, Rich.
All right, I'll go real quick. I woke up middle of the night in the pure darkness in my room, and I always slept with a backup light on. So it was kind of disturbing, and I tried to turn the lights on, and I couldn't. So I felt my way out into the hall, and I went to turn the light on there, and it wouldn't work. I had a sinking feeling when that happened. Then immediately to my right, I saw right there, less than 2 feet away, was a tall figure, absolutely jet black, darker than the darkness, and it had no face. I was right there close enough, and it spoke to me, and it said, the man, in a formal tone, it said, the man who would be with me would be a man such as this man. And then, like a video projector at the hole end of our hall, I could see it looked like it was on the wall of an ocean, and a man in a little boat on the sea in the storm at night. I could see there was a hole in the front of the boat, and he was running back and forth in terror. And pretty soon, all I could see was the storm and the lightning. He was sunk. He was gone. And I turned around, and no more shadow figure.
Wow. Okay, well, Richard, you know, right off the bat, when you told me that, I immediately thought of the Newby Phantom. It's spelled N-E-W-B-Y. It's a picture that was taken in the 1960s of this tall, I mean, extremely creepy, dark figure. It was taken at a church in England, as a matter of fact. And I have been fascinated with that picture for years, and I've kept gathering reports of people who have seen similar types of beings. And often they appear at night, and they seem to be one of these types of creatures, if you will, or beings, that is there to feed off of the energy of a person who is unaware that they are being fed off of. You know, we have to energize ourselves by putting stuff in our mouth and chewing it up and swallowing it. I think there are beings out there that can absorb it directly, and some of these really dark, creepy figures, I believe, they come and they are predators. They predate off of our energy.
They're everywhere. Josh, I want to thank you again. Keep in touch. Good luck with all your shows, okay?
Thank you so much, George.
Joshua P. Warren up next. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Plus, have you been cursed? We'll talk about that.